The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Logan Shannon, in for Virginia Prescott. In Hollywood, getting noticed by a director, a producer, or a casting agent is a good thing. But for an extra, getting noticed can actually get you kicked off a set. Extras, or background actors, as they prefer to be called, are meant to blend in, to make scenes feel authentic without distracting from the real stars. It's a menial job, the pay is lousy, and it's rare for an extra to make the jump from the background to the spotlight. But for an elite group of background actors, it's a pretty sweet job. Freelance writer Hillel Aaron wrote about the sometimes lucrative job of being an extra in Hollywood for LA Weekly, and Virginia started the conversation by asking what separates the haves from the have-nots in the world of professional extras.
Yeah, that's right. There's a small group of extras that are in the union, the Screen Actors Guild, and within that group, there are extras that work almost exclusively on commercials, and they get paid quite a bit of money. And it's really, like everything in Hollywood, it's really just who you know, the directors and the assistant directors and the producers that maybe you're friends with, or you've just worked with them a lot, and they know you're kind of reliable and, you know, low maintenance. And, you know, some of these guys can make, $40,000, $50,000, even $100,000 a year.
So that's union scale, but it's not as if people just get paid hourly. There's this kind of, Byzantine
exactly.
system.
Exactly. There's this very complicated ladder of payment. A SAG actor working on a commercial will get $342 for the first 8 hours. For hours 9 and 10, that goes to time and a half. And then starting in hour 10, that's double time. And then starting with hour 16, you go into what they call golden time, where you get $342 an hour.
Wow.
And now, if that's not enough, on weekends, most of that is doubled. And you get little bumps for bringing a car, for bringing an extra set of clothes, for working in the rain, working in smoke. So it's not unheard of to work for a day or two and get $7,000, $8,000.
Wow, not bad. But you talk to a lot of actors who do work on commercials. Is it similar in the film extra world?
Not at all. The film extra world typically pays minimum wage, and even the union actors don't get paid nearly as much on films as they do on commercials. TV shows in particular are bad because they're hardly ever overtime, because the productions on TV shows are kind of well-oiled machines with people that work together every day.
I would think that on a commercial, you might actually like to push it a little bit and make it a longer shoot.
Absolutely. You don't hear people complaining when it goes in overtime, that's for sure.
Well, union background actors are a pretty elite group, and some of them that you spoke to didn't even want to give you their names. What, for fear of being found out, or, someone's going to catch on that they're making this much money?
I think that's right. I think people just sort of have their head down and are getting hired day after day, and they're afraid that if their name gets out, people will say, "Oh, well, he doesn't need a check. He's making plenty of money."
Wow.
And I think some of the extras that I talked to in the end wished they hadn't talked to me.
So, how do background actors gain entry into SAG-AFTRA?
That is a complicated question. There are two ways you can get a speaking part in a commercial, film, or TV show, or you can work on three union jobs. You get sort of bumped from non-union to union status, and it's very complicated, the things that have to fall into place for that to happen. But again, it's largely who you know. If you're friends with an assistant director that works a lot, it can happen in a few months easy. If maybe you're an attractive girl, it can happen rather easily. For other people, maybe wouldn't happen so easily.
You're giving us a bit of a lesson in how the industry works, as they say in L.A., but I'm just wondering about how, wouldn't the lust for profits make more productions, commercial productions in this case, non-union? How does it work there?
Yeah, I actually kept asking people, you know, why the contract for commercials were so good, and no one could really tell me why. As close as I could figure it, it comes down to who's paying. If Paramount Pictures is paying for everything, then the incentive is to try to keep the cost down. But if Coca-Cola is paying for things, maybe people aren't as tight-fisted.
Hmm. So what can you tell us about the history of extras and unions in the film industry?
Yeah, there have been extras in movies for almost as long as there have been movies. People used to, literally drive up to studio gates and, or I guess not drive, they'd maybe walk or take the rail car, but they used to walk up to the gates of movie studios and assistant directors would come out and just point to people.
Hmm.
And there are all these stories about the way Cecil B. DeMille treated his hundreds of extras, which not very well. If you were lucky, you'd get a dollar a day in lunch.
Mm-hmm. And now you talk to people who are saying, it's like stealing. You know, we get fed every half hour and we make so much money.
Yeah. And again, I mean, those are sort of the small minority. The I don't know. You might even call them the 1%, if you will. there are plenty of other extras that are out there struggling, that under poor treatment or just with these lofty ambitions that aren't getting met. So still plenty of people struggle, but yeah, I think it's safe to say that once SAG, actually initially the extras formed a union called the Screen Extras Guild, but they were never really financially sustainable, and eventually SAG-AFTRA kind of absorbed them. And but really, I think once Central Casting was born, treatment started to get better. Central Casting is kind of the extras casting agency. It was, for a while, it was the first and only extras casting agency. Now it's just the biggest. But once they started to operate, treatment of extras began to get better. So Central Casting is where you go and say, I'm filming a wedding. I need 50 old-looking Jewish guys.
Well, Hillel, thank you so much for giving us a little behind-the-scenes look at Hollywood extras.
No problem. Thank you.
Hillel Aaron there speaking with Virginia Prescott about his article for LA Weekly, Some Hollywood Extras Suffer, But Others Are Rolling in It. You can find a link to the article at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Logan Shannon, in for Virginia Prescott. Bob Odenkirk is a busy man. After hitting the big time as strip mall lawyer Saul Goodman on Breaking Bad, he is starring in that show's spinoff, Better Call Saul, and the second season debuted on AMC this week. Long before becoming a Hollywood face, he'd reached near cult status for his contribution to the world of sketch comedy. First as a writer for Saturday Night Live, then The Ben Stiller Show, Late Night with Conan O'Brien, and as co-creator of Mr. Show with David Cross, in which he wrote and played characters ranging from a hyper-conservative Dixiecrat senator.
New Mexico! When was the last time anybody was in New Mexico? Be serious. Grand Canyon, just sitting out there collecting dust. The Great Lakes, cluttered with water. I believe it's time to sell it. We're taking bids now. Best offer gets it.
To a morally bankrupt British TV producer.
Ronnie, I'm going to put it to you bluntly. How long have you been not drinking?
Terry, I drink all the time. You know me, come on.
No, you come on, Ronnie. What's in this?
Terry, come on, that's my cocaine.
Bull Ronnie, it's f***ing baking soda.
A similar array of voices is evident in Odenkirk's debut collection of writings, A Load of Hooey, in which he channels out-of-touch politicians, dissatisfied critics, and for some reason, Paul McCartney. Virginia spoke with Bob Odenkirk the day his book was published and started the conversation by asking him whether comedy was a way for him to communicate his ideas on the big issues.
Absolutely. it is also a playground to kick things around in. So I don't really feel like I condemn all religion or all politicians. In fact, I don't like people who do that. But comedy and these pieces are a place to ridicule some of the sillier aspects, including the hot button issues.
I'm thinking of the essay, putting it out there, you know, which begins, if I were running for president, and then you announce you're being transparent, like the character says, I cheated on my wife, Betty, many, many different ways with many, many different people. Do you wish politicians would do that? Or are you making fun of this sort of public fascination with private life?
The public fascination with private life. I think we just go too far digging into people's peccadilloes and caring about them or pretending to care about them. You know, I was not a fan of George Bush, but I don't care if he did cocaine when he was in college. He could have done it 10 times. I don't care. I just want to know what he stands for. You know, is he upright most days? And how is he going to lead us? And I don't care if Obama smoked pot. And let's move on. We got work to do.
Well, the politician is one voice. You're a politician in another essay. I misspoke. A number of different voices here. And I wonder, you know, similar to the way that you do sketches, is this how your comedic mind works? You come up with characters and sketches and you start to flesh them out?
Yeah. And in fact, I've done a certain amount of stand-up, and it's sort of the same thing. I enjoy getting a hold of a voice or a point of view, having fun with it and digging in and going places with it. I find that more rewarding than just making observations. Mm. I mean, it goes back to my childhood. I'm from a family of seven, and our dinner table was a show every night. And we would get up and we would do the people we met that day. It was all clean comedy. My mother is very Catholic. You know, it's just getting a hold of a point of view and seeing how far it can go. I think it is a commentary, though. I mean, when you go look at your point of view, now let's take it further to a comic extent. And if it's ridiculous, then maybe it's ridiculous just on the face of it all across the board.
Yeah, I'm also one of many children, and it was something I wanted to ask you about, because it's funny, dinner table does become the stage, doesn't it? You've got to work out your characters. You've got to work out your shtick if you want to be heard in this crowd.
Yeah, I mean, we would literally get up from the meal.
Oh.
And then acting it out.
You did stand-up at dinner?
Well, I don't know if it was the stand-up, it was characters and more sketch comedy. So I guess it paid off.
And that sketch comedy came across so beautifully in Mr. Show and other things that you've worked on, Saturday Night Live, we mentioned, and Ben Stiller's show. But Mr. Show is kind of a cult classic now and widely considered to be a kind of a watershed moment for alternative comedy. But it was not so popular at the time. What do you think changed, Bob Odenkirk? You know, why did it later catch on?
Well, I don't know the answer. My guess is the internet and YouTube and that kind of sharing of short comedy bits has helped us a lot. But the wave of sketch comedy that comes out of the UCB Theater, Second City in Chicago, Improv Olympic in Chicago, and in Los Angeles, and all the classes and all the improv groups and sketch groups, and now all the sketch shows on TV, I don't know where that came from. I do think it's going to be short-lived. I don't think sketch comedy will ever go away, and I hope it doesn't because I love it. But I do think we're living in a little bubble of cultural excitement over sketch comedy, and then everyone will move on to something else. I remember the stand-up boom in the 80s. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that was crazy. We went from having like two clubs in Chicago to having like eight. And then there was, literally comedy, stand-up comedy night, literally every night of the week. Monday night, you could go to a bar and they'd have stand-up night. And if you could write some jokes, you could get paid $20.
But I wonder for you, Bob, you know, you've been kind of a guru to the web generation. You've inspired people. Derek Waters of Drunk History acknowledges you. Adult Swim's Tim and Eric.
Yeah.
How do you feel about being a sort of an elder on the comedy scene?
Well, you know, listen, I understand what you're saying, and it's very nice. I mean, I had mentors like Del Close, one of the great teachers of improvisation, who inspired me to do this. So I know what that's like. I mean, I got to say, I don't do it consciously. I don't think, how can I be a teacher today, or how can I go be important to younger performers? I do my own thing. I write stuff. Right now I'm acting in Better Call Saul, which is a spinoff of Breaking Bad. But I can't help myself when I see a young act like Tim and Eric sent me their DVDs years ago, and I put it in and I watch it and I think, oh my God, these guys have a voice. I've never seen it before. It's exciting. It's funny. It's weird. It deserves a stage. I can't help but want to call them, talk to them. How are you doing it? Here's what I think you could do. I made a huge mistake when I was young.
What's that?
I've been at Saturday Night Live for 2 years, and I took all the money I had, and I made a one-hour special for TV. I don't know for who, and had costumes and locations, and we shot it, and we edited it, and we did the sound mix. It cost a lot of money. It did get me some attention. The HBO executives watched it. They called me in for a meeting, and they said, this is really cool. We can't put it on. No one knows who you are. We can't just put that on. No one will let us. But you know, you're good, and we think you're neat. And later I worked on the Ben Stiller Show, which they produced, and then obviously Mr. Show, and I actually did 4 or 5 pilots with that team over at HBO over the years. So I made friends. But here's the thing. I didn't need to make a one-hour special. I could have achieved everything I achieved by shooting a 15-minute sampler. And that's where I think somebody with more experience can give you a shortcut, can see what you're doing and say, here's a couple ideas that can save you 2 years.
Well, let me ask you about that, because now, you know, you've been on Breaking Bad. Now you're developing Better Call Saul with Breaking Bad's showrunner, Vince Gilligan. And this is after years of being, you know, not the face. You were behind the scenes in the writer's room, feeding and partnering with and feeding the careers of a stunning list of comedic talent. So how does that transition to being the face, a more recognizable, a more visible presence, feel to you?
I try not to think about it.
You've got a good face.
I have a doughy face.
Do you?
I do.
Well, you look very authorial in the one where you're wearing glasses, you have a cat on your lap, smoking a pipe,
awesome.
Holding a glass of wine.
You're awesome. That I did that for you. I did that for you.
I felt it.
And I wanted to do multiple author photos and multiple about the author things. You know, the book is an indulgence. In the end notes, I thank the Lily Guild. And I don't know if you know what gilding the lily means.
I do.
Yeah, because I know that my comedy writer friends, some of them are going to go, great job. I've already had a few. And some of them, are reading it going, oh, he just went on and on with his little ideas. They're going to see that I just dug in and indulged myself. And, you know, hey, that's what the book is, you know.
Bob Odenkirk, last year you co-authored another book, Hollywood Said No, with David Cross. It's kind of a collection of rejected scripts that you'd submitted.
Mm-hmm.
Are things going to be different now that Hollywood seems to be saying a big fat yes?
Yeah, I don't know if it is saying a big fat yes. I mean, look, Vince Gilligan is saying a big fat yes.
Fargo is saying a yes. Alexander Payne is saying a yes. You seem to be quite in demand.
I'm very thankful, and I can't believe it, and I'll just try to keep my mouth shut and not jinx this little run of luck I have here. I really got to tell you, this show, Better Call Saul, is kind of mind-blowing.
Well, it's supposed to be a prequel. Are we going to see Saul before he has his comb-over, for example, and before he has the inflatable Statue of Liberty in his office?
Yes, you are.
Oh.
I can't tell you much, but I can tell you that.
Okay.
And I can tell you that Vince Gilligan is, and Peter Gould, they're the two creators of the show, are just setting new standards for me for the writing I'm reading and the work I get to do. And I can't wait to see it and share it with people. And it's just been a crazy challenge and a joy to do it. And I don't know. I don't know what to say. I mean, I don't know what to say to good fortune. I'm much better at talking about failure than I am with talking about good fortune. I don't know what to do with that.
Bob Odenkirk, I want to thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
That's Virginia Prescott speaking with actor, comedian, and writer Bob Odenkirk, star of the AMC show Better Call Saul. Blue lights start a blinking, those handcuffs click. You know who to call, and you better call quick. Saul, you better call. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Logan Shannon, in for Virginia Prescott. In 1906, the passage of the Pure Food and Drug Act prohibited the making, trafficking, and sale of quote-unquote misbranded, poisonous, or adulterated food and drugs. While intended to protect the public from ingesting risky products, the road leading to the act put a few individuals in harm's way. This story comes to us from Shruthi Pinnamaneni.
Picture this. It's the winter of 1902. We're in Washington, D.C., in the basement of a government building. 12 young men, boys really, are sitting down to dinner. Their suits are neatly pressed and their mustaches are stiff with wax. Waiters are serving them courses like chipped beef, turnips, and celery on toast. But there's a problem with all this fancy food. It's been spiked with an unidentified poison. The men know this, but they go ahead and eat everything on their plates. The newspapers have a name for these guys. They are the Poison Squad. This ritual poisoning is actually a government project. Congress has signed off on it, and it will go on like this for years. The mastermind behind this experiment, he's standing at the head of the table, watching his boys eat. His name is Harvey Washington Wiley.
That's an early picture of him. Look at the homespun jacket and his derby hat.
Suzanne Junot is a historian at the Food and Drug Administration.
Wiley was born in 1844 in Indiana on a farm, and he decided fairly early, I think, that he didn't want to be a farmer.
Instead, Wiley went to a college nearby, bringing all his provisions from home. He writes in his biography,
"We brought potatoes, cornmeal, and sorghum molasses. We also brought butter from home and made arrangements with a German woman to bake our flour into bread."
But this intimate connection with food, knowing what was in your bread and your butter, this was all about to change by the 1900s.
50% of all Americans now lived in cities.
That's Melanie Warner. She wrote a book about processed foods called Pandora's Lunchbox.
They had moved off the farm, so they had to rely on other people that they didn't know, strangers, companies, to produce their food.
This food was all coming from far away places. There were tins of bright green peas or cans of gooey pink meat. The labels back then didn't always have a list of ingredients, so if you were staring at one of these cans trying to figure out what was in it, you could only guess. By this point, Wiley was 37 years old. He was working as state chemist of Indiana. He starts using this thing called a polariscope, which is basically a microscope that uses a special light source. He points his lens at this golden liquid from a tin labeled Pure Maple Syrup of Vermont, and sees that
maple syrup has been displaced by glucose.
Cheap glucose from corn, nothing like the stuff that oozes out of a maple tree. In a can of green peas, he finds
sulfate of copper to give them a vivid green color.
Even pumpkin pie wasn't pumpkin pie anymore, but
mashed turnip, colored yellow, with annatto.
Now, keep in mind there were no laws against this at the time, so food companies could do pretty much anything they wanted.
They would take rotting meat and rotting eggs and doctor them up with chemical preservatives, passing them off as fresh meat.
So people were eating this rotten meat, except they didn't know that it was rotten or that it had been treated with borax, this white powder that we nowadays use to clean clothes or kill ants. They also didn't know that the milk they were drinking had been mixed in with formaldehyde. Dairy companies did that to keep old milk from going sour. By now, Wiley had worked his way up into a pretty powerful position. He was chief chemist of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He had a hunch that these food chemicals were harmful, deadly even. But how could he prove it?
The solution was obvious.
Fortunately, the Department of Agriculture is richly provided with subjects for experiments, if only their consent be obtained.
So Wiley recruited a dozen clerks and low-level employees. In exchange for free room and board, they signed a pledge that they will not hold the government responsible for any illness or accident, including death. And in December 1902, the experiments began. The men lived and ate in the Bureau of Chemistry. A chef prepared the meals.
Roast lamb, 66 grams, potatoes.
And Wiley would spike these meals.
Peas, 50 grams.
With increasing doses of borax.
I gather peaches were used as dessert. Canned peaches, of course.
Everyone had to submit all their bodily fluids, their stool samples, urine samples, pretty much daily.
Wiley even built a special fecal drying machine to analyze the piles of evidence he was collecting.
With number 5, the constipation has given way to looseness of the bowels. 4 evacuations taking place during the day.
When they got too sick to continue the work, he would take them off the experiments and give them what he called clean food.
Number 5 is quite ill with a sick headache and diarrhea. No borax is administered on April 27th.
Over the course of 5 years, about 50 men served on the squad. Group by group, they ate borax, formaldehyde, salicylic acid, sulfuric acid, sodium benzoate, potassium nitrate. They lived with sharp stomach cramps, fevers, nausea. Several men dropped out midway, and one man never recovered and died months later in his mother's home.
An enterprising reporter got wind that this was happening in the Bureau of Agriculture, and he started interviewing the chef through a basement window. And once he wrote the story, he actually gave them the name the Poison Squad.
The public couldn't get enough. The news stories about the squad bounced between outrageous and outraged. There were headlines like Poison Eater Dead or Salicylic Acid Hurts. And after years of this, the stories paid off. Wiley finally got what he wanted, a food law, a big one.
How does a general feel who wins a great battle and brings a final end to hostilities? I presume I felt that way on the last day of June, 1906.
That's the day that Congress passed the Pure Food and Drug Act. This law would lay the grounds for what would eventually become the FDA. Now, for the first time, food companies could be fined if they lied on their labels, and states could ban specific chemicals from food, which many did. Well, for a while anyway. Over the next few years, Wiley kept pushing to enforce the new food safety laws, like a sting operation on Coca-Cola, where his agents seized 40 barrels of soda to test what was in them. His government colleagues started to see him as a zealot, unfriendly to business. Food companies protested about a couple of the Poison Squad chemicals that had been banned, like sodium benzoate.
All these ketchup manufacturers wanted to keep using it. They said that our ketchup will go bad if we don't have sodium benzoate in it.
Again, that's author Melanie Warner. The ketchup companies lobbied the Department of Agriculture.
It was a very narrow victory to keep sodium benzoate on the market, and it's been on the market ever since.
You can find it in everything from salad dressings to sodas, where it's used as a preservative. The FDA says sodium benzoate is safe in controlled doses. Just out of curiosity, I tried to find another big study that shows what happens when humans eat sodium benzoate, but I couldn't. There is no other study on the same scale as Wiley's experiment. Wiley resigned from his government job in 1912, but he didn't stop fighting for this ideal of pure food. He spent his remaining years writing for the magazine Good Housekeeping, where he became famous for his seal of approval and his diatribes against tobacco and Coca-Cola and bleached white flour and high fructose corn syrup and saccharin, and gelatin, and food dyes.
I've always stood for food that is food.
And that story was produced by Shruthi Pinnamanini, with editing and sound design by Brendan Baker. This production is part of the STEM Story Project, with support from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, presented by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Logan Shannon, in for Virginia Prescott. For comedian Maj Gibrani, acts of terrorism feel somehow personal. Here he is on his I Come in Peace comedy tour.
Like, I don't know if you guys remember this, a couple years ago in Times Square, there was a Pakistani guy tried to blow up a car bomb in Times Square. Now, I happened to be there that night doing shows just a few blocks away. And a few months before that, in Austin, Texas, there was a white guy who flew his plane into the IRS building in Austin, Texas. And I happened to be in Austin, Texas that day doing a show. Yeah. Yeah. As a Middle Eastern male, when you start showing up around a lot of these activities, you start feeling guilty at one point. I was watching the news. I'm like, am I involved in this crap?
You may know Maj Gibrani as a panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, but he is also the author of the memoir, I'm Not a Terrorist, But I Play One on TV. Virginia spoke to Maj when it was first published. It is now available in paperback.
Maj Gibrani, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me. How you doing?
Well, I'm very well and very excited to talk with you because, you know, I've wondered what it's like for someone who is of Middle Eastern descent. You know, you're joking there about profiling yourself after so many experiences of being profiled. And I couldn't help but wonder if comedy is a way of getting to the truth. What part of that is true for you?
Well, you know, it is. I think comedy, I always say, is like therapy. And we talk about the truth and we laugh at it. We laugh through it, I guess. A lot of that is true. I mean, it's funny because ultimately, I personally have never been profiled at an airport, but I have friends and family who've had things happen to them. I read about it all the time. And so eventually it gets in your head. So I know specifically after September 11th, the first time I traveled, I felt guilty. I didn't know why. I hadn't done anything, but there was so much, I think, antagonism towards people that look like me that I felt like I was going to be stopped and interrogated. It's that feeling of when you go through that metal detector and you feel like something's going to beep. Mm. That got to like a really extreme place. So it's interesting. I talk about it in the book. I talk about getting these silly ideas in your head of like, maybe like there's some organization who knows of me and they're doing terrorist things around where I am. I don't know what. So this weird paranoia sets in. I don't know why.
Well, maybe you haven't been profiled in an airport, but you were typecast long before September 11th. You dropped out of UCLA. You were on the stand-up circuit and the manager, was it at the Comedy Store, told you to wear the outfit, you know, like a robe and a turban.
Yeah, you know, Mitzi Shore, who's the owner of the Comedy Store, and she, I always preface this story by saying I owe a lot of my career to her because the Comedy Store in Los Angeles is this mecca of comedy. You want to be a regular at this club and be there and grow. And the way you become a regular is by auditioning in front of Mitzi Shore. This was when she was healthier. She's a little older now and she's not at the club anymore. And the night when I auditioned, I remember doing the set, and as I was walking off the stage, she goes, congratulations, you're very funny. That's how she talks, and I go, thank you, Mitzi. And she goes, I'm going to make you a regular. I go, thank you. She goes, have you ever thought about wearing the outfit? And I was like, outfit? She goes, yeah, you know, the hat and the gown. And then she makes kind of a circly gesture, and I go, oh, like a turban. She's like, yeah, I think you should wear that. And then I have this moment in my mind where I'm like, do I say no? Or do I accept and, you know, sell my soul? And I basically was like, yeah, Mitzi, that's a great idea. I'll definitely wear the outfit. And I walked out of the club and I'm thinking, what did I just agree to do?
But you sort of played the stereotype to get out of it too. How'd you do that?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I turned the card so fast because I had like a week or two of just trying to get out of wearing the turban. And finally, I remembered hearing that there was an Iranian performer in Los Angeles who used to make fun of the mullahs. And supposedly, I guess he was at an event, some Iranians showed up, they threw a rock, and they blinded him in an eye. So I called up the club, and I said, listen, I don't know if you guys have heard about this, but these guys take it seriously, and I could wear a turban, but if I do, they may show up, and they may attack me. Worse yet, they may attack the club. And so they said, you know what, just wear something casual. And I got out of that one.
Well, this has come up for you over and over in one of your early movie roles. You played a terrorist in a Chuck Norris film. And mind you, Chuck Norris did play a college professor in that same film. But there was kind of a moment of clarity for you about that role and what you wanted to do in the future. What happened for you?
It was early in my career. I had a day job at an advertising agency. I was an assistant. I was hoping to find more film and TV work that would let me quit my day job. So I got this gig on this Chuck Norris movie of the week, and I was playing an Afghan terrorist who was going to blow up a building in Chicago. This was pre-9/11. And I thought, okay, you know what? At least I'll get it right. Because, you know, as you said, you know, Chuck is doing something different. He's going to be a professor in this movie. I was like, maybe they're thinking outside the box here. So I went to the wardrobe fitting, and I was playing an Afghan in America, and they go, here's your shirt, here's your pants, here's your turban. And I was like, oh, I go, listen, let's get this right. You know, Afghans don't wear turbans. Indian Sikhs in America wear turbans. And they're like, dude, this is a Chuck Norris movie. What are you talking about? And finally I said, listen, you tell the producers I'm not going to wear the turban. It's not right. It's not the right thing to do. So I showed up the next day, and there's my shirt, there's my pants, and there's what looks like a scarf. So I was like, oh, scarf. I go, I have no problem being a scarf-wearing terrorist. And she's like, that's not a scarf. That's the turban. You got to wrap it around your head. I was like, oh, man. And then when I came back to Los Angeles, I told my agents and you know, that no more terrorist parts.
Well, so what happened then? What kind of roles could you get?
I've played cab drivers. I've played falafel shop owners. I don't mind those parts because I feel like I know those people. When I go to New York, when I go to Chicago, you know, there's people like that that own these places or drive the cabs. But I've never met a terrorist. I don't know a terrorist. And the bigger thing about the terrorist thing is that I feel like it's such a small percentage of the population, yet it represents the population so much in American film and television.
I'm speaking with the actor and comedian, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me panelist, and now author Maz Jobani. His new memoir is called I'm Not a Terrorist, But I Played One on TV. Well, let's talk about you growing up. You came to the U.S. long before any of these roles, and before the 1979 revolution. Your impression of America was largely formed through television shows like The $6 Million Man, like Dallas Dynasty. So what did you expect when you came here? You know, big hair and cowboy hats?
Yeah, I was 6 years old, and it was right before the Iranian Revolution. I always say that a lot of people didn't realize the revolution was actually going to happen. My father was on business in New York, and at the time it was our winter break from school, so he sent for my mother to bring my sister and me to New York to be with him for a couple of weeks during our winter break. And I always say we packed for 2 weeks, we stayed for 35 years or whatever it is now. And as a kid, I didn't know much. I remember coming to America. My father was a successful businessman, so he was staying at the Plaza Hotel in New York, and it happened to be right across the street from FAO Schwartz.
You were in heaven.
Yeah, I'm like, wow, America is amazing. And I was thinking, this revolution is really working out for me. And I was just a kid, and none of the geopolitical stuff really hit me until, I believe, when we moved out to Northern California, and that's around the time the hostage crisis happened. And I talk about in the book about having a sixth grader pick on me for being from Iran and calling me an effing Iranian. That's what they called you back then.
Iranian.
Mm-hmm. And jokingly, I would tell them, you know, it's not Iranian, it's Iranian. Secondly, you're bigger than me, so it's whatever you want it to be, you know. And thirdly, I'm not even Iranian, I'm Italian. Ciao.
So you were trying to pass or become invisible even. How'd that work out for you?
You know, it didn't work out that well because you would try to pass and then your loud immigrant parents would show up and always out you. You know, one thing that I learned early was as a kid, I was a good athlete. That helped. I think that that's around the time that I realized that being funny helped. And I think that that's probably what led me to get into this world of comedy, just trying to make people laugh and accept you. Again, things would go great until your rich Persian dad would pull up in a Rolls Royce to pick you up, and you'd be like, oh, dude.
I love the idea of also your entire family, all your relatives showing up when you had soccer practice.
Oh, my God. It was crazy. It's like, I don't know why. I don't know if it's an immigrant mentality. I jokingly say in the car that I think that we're afraid that a revolution is going to happen from the house on the way to picking me up at soccer. So the whole family gets in the car. In case a revolution happens, we could just keep driving to Argentina.
It's funny reading the voice that you give to your relatives in the book. To me, it reads like a traditional Jewish mother voice. Is there something going on there? Is there a similarity? Am I reading that right?
No, you're absolutely right. As a matter of fact, I always explain to people that when I perform in an audience that has immigrants, I think that I find the similarities between Jewish mothers, Middle Eastern, you know, Iranian mothers, Arab mothers, Italian mothers. There's this commonality that they all have, the whole thing of like feeding you, the thing of you know, wanting to find you a wife at a young age, a good wife that they approve of. It's not about who you approve; it's who they approve. You know, them wanting to be a lawyer or a doctor because that's what the community wants. There's so many similarities; it's ridiculous. And it's funny. I've actually been talking about this recently. When I first started with my stand-up, you know, I've been doing stand-up for 17 years. I would talk about being Iranian and, you know, my Iranian parents. But as I kept going, I realized that I started replacing that word with immigrant. Hmm. And that came one night I was doing a joke about how my mother told me, you know, to save my money and where to put my money. And jokingly, I said, you know, we don't put it in 401ks. They encourage us to do what our grandmothers do, which is to put it in our bras. That's where my grandmother would put all her money, in her bra. And as I was telling that joke, there was these two Mexican girls at the Laugh Factory, and they were just cracking up. And I realized, oh, wow, their grandmother puts her money in her bra as well. And it made me realize that we have so many things in common that it's pretty amazing.
You have done stand-up now all over the Middle East, but never in Iran. And there's so many active, passionate expatriates from Iran. Do you ever get any pressure to really take on the politics or the religion in an aggressive way, you know, kind of take a stand?
You know, it's interesting. First of all, the reason I've never done shows in Iran is because I've done jokes in the past that make fun of the leadership. So right. I don't want to show up and test it, you know, because I don't think I'd get past the airport. You know, they'd say, oh, we've been waiting for you. Where have you been? You know, you're performing tonight in Evin prison. So that's why I've never even thought about going there. For the most part, I think people that come to my shows, they appreciate that I kind of gingerly step around the political stuff, and I make jabs. You know, during the Bush administration, I would make fun of Bush and Ahmadinejad, and it felt to me like they were the same guy. They were comedy gold, those two guys. So I think a lot of people appreciate that, and sometimes people will, you know, give you suggestions with things happening in Iran. I mean, right now the nuclear issue obviously is a hot issue. Mm-hmm. And I've been talking about that for a long time, the nuclear issue. You know, I used to make fun of the fact that it was, you know, a peaceful nuclear program and, you know, we blow you up, then we hug you. And then now the joke I'm making about it is just how long it's taken to do the negotiations and how anyone who has any Persian friends knows that our hellos take hours of bowing and, you know, kissing. And so I said, that's why it's taking so long, because every time the Americans show up to negotiate, the Iranians just keep saying, hello, hi, hello, like keep bowing. Once the Americans are finally ready to negotiate, the Iranians want to have some tea. That's what's been taking so long, is all the formalities.
Well, I guess that we should start saying goodbye now, Maz, because, I don't know, we've got, 10 minutes left on the clock.
Oh, yeah. I'm telling you, if you ever want to see how ridiculous it is, go to a Persian wedding. It's like half an hour of hellos, 45 minutes of goodbyes. I mean, I've done shows before where most of the audience is seated, but the Persians are out in the lobby still saying hi. And the manager's like, can we get started? I go, yeah, get started. He goes, but there's like, you know, he's like 50% are out in the hall. I go, don't worry. As soon as the lights go out, they're coming in.
Oh, Maz, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. This was fun.
That's Maz Jobrani, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me regular, talking about his memoir, I'm Not a Terrorist, But I Play One on TV. It is now available in paperback. Thanks for your listening time today. There's lots more to check out at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, don't fret. You can always catch the show in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org, or you can search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. If you like the podcast, we really hope you'll tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Logan Shannon, in for Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.